Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
Ryan, let's dive into the mailbag, and let's start off with, I appreciate this comment from Alan Watson. You're both freaks in journalism. Thank you. And then
is that good or bad?
I think it's good. Alan, I think you meant that in love. At least that's what I'm going to tell myself and make me feel better. Tommy Guns had a question that I thought was interesting. Is Cam Hart what Dante Vaughn could have been had he stayed healthy?
I would say this. Brian, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I think Cam Hart is significantly more talented than Dante Vaughn. I think Dante Vaughn should have been a much better player at Notre Dame if injuries did not occur. Because, I mean, when he was a freshman, I was like, dude.
He was their best corner when he was a freshman. Yeah, he was their best corner in 2016.
I was like, dude, he's going to be a baller, right? And it's a similar in the sense, Tommy, that they're both long and super big corners, sure. But I just think Cam's a better athlete overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he's definitely a better athlete. I mean, that's the thing is, even with all of Dante was really good as a freshman because he's long, he's pretty strong, he has really good instincts. You know, as a corner guy, he played the ball really well. You know, flipped his hips okay, but it was really just about the length, and the speed for his length was good.
Yeah,
Cam is freaky for it athletically. And I also think the other thing that helps Cam too is Cam is a lot more fluid and clean as an athlete. You know, Dante was always a guy that was either going to be a press guy or an off guy. You know, and as a press guy, I was like, if he doesn't jam you at the line, he's in trouble.
Yes.
And we saw that against Clemson. You know, he missed on some jams and he just couldn't recover. Cam's got better recovery speed. But we never did see Dante at his best because of the injuries. And Mike Elko, for whatever reason, just wasn't as high on him as he was other guys, which is fine. I don't think he necessarily fit that system a whole lot. He did get a chance to kind of earn some playing time, but even then he couldn't stay healthy. But he had some really good games in his career. I mean, he was in 2019 against Virginia Tech. He was outstanding. He couldn't stay healthy and he never got back to being his peak athlete. But Dante spent like 2 years in the NFL with the Chargers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it says a lot, but yeah, they're different players, I would say, Tommy, I understand where the comparison comes from. I do. 100%.
Similar-sized guys, right? I mean, like, they're both about 6'2" and some change and have long arms. And, yeah, I totally get where it's coming from.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, no issue with that. But they're different type of players. And the upside for Cam is much better. Much better than the other.
Agree.
Got another one here from 99 Problems BK1. He says, I mean, I'm not actually surprised. I don't know. Foskey seems underrated to me, but my Notre Dame fandom might cause me to overrate Foskey. I don't think that your fandom is causing you to overrate Isaiah Foskey. I think that's the thing when I'll ask myself, Ryan, okay, am I overrating a guy? Mm-hmm. It's when I'm the only person that feels that way.
Right.
And it doesn't mean I'm going to change my opinion. But at least means I'm going to be like, okay, let me rethink this. Like, I know you and I have both done this with Jason Adamiola. Yeah. We've both gone back and like, okay, I'm just going to watch the film again. And maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm overhyping him or I'm overlooking some holes in his game or some flaws and things like that. Right. And you go back to it and you're like, no, I still feel the same way. So yeah. I, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I'm still going to own it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But Foskey's a guy that's getting the love everywhere. It's not just Notre Dame fans. It's NFL draft people. And I mean, Bruce Feldman a year ago before he even broke out had him on the freaks list, right? Yeah. At number 45. I don't know what Foskey's done to not be on there this year, but you know, it is what it is. But you know, I don't think 99 that you're over. The only way you can overrate Isaiah Foskey, you're like, he's going to be the number one pick and he's going to have 19 sacks this year. And you know, okay, buddy, like pump the brakes. Yeah. But no, if you think he's like one of the best edge players in the country and he's a freaky athlete for pound for pound, no, you're not overrating him. You're kind of saying what everybody else that's evaluated him thinks about him.
And you should always check your bias though. So I agree with you completely. Like I graded out Isaiah Foskey very high from an NFL draft perspective, but I know that I have an allegiance to Notre Dame and I have a fandom, right? So I reached out to 3 to 4 different NFL scouts and then I get the NFS report back also from the NFL side of things. And everyone's high on Isaiah Foskey. So I was like, okay, cool. I'm just verifying basically that I'm not biased in that regard. Isaiah Foskey is a fantastic talent, fantastic player. NFL people like him. College football fans, for the most part, give him, I think, his due as far as being one of the better defensive linemen in college football. So I don't think you're overrating him at all. I think that he is a fantastic player, one of the best players in college football, in my opinion.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Somebody asked, where does Feldman get the data? Coaches, team coaches and strength coaches.
Yes. Yep. Directly from the school. Yep. So he usually does his rounds in the preseason. So he'll be around to the schools, checking in with the head coaches, the strength coaches, calling people, doing all that type of stuff. So Bruce does a great job in that regard. He does his due diligence. He's on the road for months. He's calling people for months. So it's directly from the coaches that see these players every day.
Yep. We got Josh Buffo, the motivational business banker, Brian and Ryan, in his day back in the 80s. How freaky was Brian Bosworth? Also, where would you rank him on greatest college linebackers list? Thank you, as always. Great show. You want to go ahead and take the first crack at that, a little tour before your time?
I know the legend of the Boz, right? I know the mullet. I know the, you know, the getting run over by Bo Jackson on the goal line. I know what he accomplished at Oklahoma. I have all that historical context for him, but I didn't personally see him play. I know that he was – I even saw his – didn't he have a 30 for 30 on Bosworth?
It was very well done. Very well done.
I loved that. I thought it was really – it was really fun and just kind of entertaining in that regard. And I know a good amount about Bosworth, but, like, I didn't actually see him play at Oklahoma, right? So, like, I don't know – I don't have context for telling you how freaky of an athlete he was.
And he was also admittedly on steroids. I mean, true. So that's a thing. And
it's he's very open about it.
Well, I mean, and it, when you know what he's overcome in life, you understand why he's so open about his struggles. I mean, it's part of his testimony. And it's really funny because I grew up watching when he was the Boz, right? I mean, I was a child of the 80s. I remember the, you know, the renegade he was, and I didn't particularly care for him back then, you know, I've now come around to being somewhat similar to his viewpoint on what the NCAA is all about, but Yeah, he was a great player, but, you know, I don't know if, I mean, he wasn't like Jalen Smith. He wasn't like that kind of athlete. He was really, really good. The thing about the Boz, though, he was also part of his greatness was just about the persona of the Boz. I mean, he was a great linebacker, but, like, I don't know if anyone would say, hey, this guy was an all-time great when you pop the film in. It was more about the persona. He's a really good player, but then the persona, I think, was part of it, too. Yeah. But that's the funny thing is, like, my wife and I, one of the streaming channels we subscribe to is called PureFlix, and it's, like, either Christian shows or, like, you know, wholesome shows, things like that. And there's this series of, like, post-apocalyptic, like, post-rapture, like, Wild West type shows, right? And Boz is one of the guys in there. He's in a bunch of Christian movies. So then I'm, like, watching this other Christian movie, and it's called What You Believe, and Boz is in there. And he's this really nice guy that, like, takes care of this little girl, and he's dying of cancer and all. It's just like, that's not the guy I remember growing up with the crazy hair and the steroids and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It's a pretty cool redemption story.
That's really funny, man, because he was actually in The Longest Yard as well. Remember when he was in The Longest Yard?
The one with Adam Sandler. Yeah, yes, that's right. Yep. Yeah, he was in there, I forgot about that. But, yeah, it's really funny seeing how his life has completely changed from what it was before.
Good for him.
It really is cool. It really is cool. But that's not the Boz I remember growing up. But my point is that's why he's so open with his struggles. Mm-hmm. It's a part of his Christian faith and saying, hey, look, you got to own who you were to truly find redemption and salvation. So it is pretty cool. It is pretty cool.
And he, let's be honest, man, he was kind of like, he was a trendsetter, right? Like how many mullets did you see growing up? And then, I mean, even Coastal Carolina is still rocking the mullets today, right? Like, he was revolutionary in that.
Yeah. And then like the crazy stuff on the side and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. He was a weird guy. Very weird guy back in the day.
Yep.
I like him a whole lot more now than I did then. Blaine Taylor says, B. Ryan, what excites you more this year, the start of the season or the end of the current recruiting cycle? Well, I call it even, but for completely different reasons.
Yes. I mean, honestly, it's always going to be football for me, right? Like, I just want to get to the season because I'm excited about Notre Dame football. But, Blaine, in a couple recent days, I would say that I am looking forward to the signing day and just to get this one over with because, man, some people are overreacting big time. But it's always, always, always going to be the start of football season for me.
Yeah.
It's a long off season without it.
Yeah. I'm always more of a football guy than a recruiting guy, but I'm not going to lie to you. Just the constant panic. I mean, in this chat is a perfect example about recruiting is just like, it reminds me of why I don't miss covering on a daily basis and why I hired you to do it because definitely football.
It's exhausting at times. It's exhausting.
Yeah, it really is. Especially now in this era of clickbait that now we have to respond to every like clickbait thing that gets put out there. And it's maddening. John Leahy asks, B. Ryan, do you think that Prince Colley could end up on this list next year?
That's an interesting one, John. Athletically I don't know what kind of tester he is, right? Like, from the film I've seen, looks like a freaky dude, right? Like he can move, he's explosive, he's well put together. You could talk me into it. It's just, but the other part of it is, John, is like, we talked about it. Most of the players on the list do have the name recognition stuff too. So if Prince plays a lot this year, which we're hoping that, you know, he can obviously carve out a role, but if he plays a lot and he's somewhat productive and then he has those types of crazy numbers, it's possible, but it's just, if he doesn't break out this year to a degree, then it's just, he's not going to be the first guy that you talk about for a Notre Dame football team, if that makes sense.
I think he's a good athlete. I don't think he's a freaky athlete for me. I don't think he's quite that level of guy at this point in time. Got another one from Brandon Plensner. Brandon says, which NDDBs do you expect to be matched up with Marvin Harrison and against Smith and Jigba the majority of the game on September 3rd, especially since Harrison is a 4-2 guy?
I think the easy answer for me, Brandon, is I know Brian, like we talked about this yesterday, Brian thinks that Smith and Jigba might play a little more outside, right? But
I think more than last year, yeah.
Yeah, more than last year, sure.
More because I just think they're going to move him around more is what I mean by that, right? Not that he's going to become the X, but I just think they're going to move him around more, in my opinion.
Right, right. So, I mean, in this theory for me, I think that Marvin Harrison Jr. is probably going to play more into the boundary, right? So I think that to the field, we're going to see more Smith and Jigba, and then even Emeka might be a guy that plays a little more to the field. So I actually don't think that we'll see a ton of Cam against Marvin Harrison Jr. unless he's playing more to the field. I think that that's, I mean, unless Cam is switched and is playing more into the boundary, like we've talked a ton of, but how it currently stands, I actually think that Cam's going to see more Smith and Jigba and Emeka than anything, in my opinion.
Right. Based on where they lined up last year, yes.
Yes.
Because I do think he's going to play more outside Jackson Smith and Jigba. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's playing like in the boundary a whole lot. I could see him. This is where I come from. Like Ryan Day, to me, if he's smart, he's got to know that like last year it made sense to play him the way that they played him. But there's things you can do with him. Is he that – he's not smaller than Devontae Smith, and Devontae Smith played every game you'd see him in snaps in the boundary. Because you could do some things to create isolations. You could run off the wide side guys, you know, run like vertical routes, you know, kind of a three-layered all verts from that side, you know, vertical seam, backside seam, or run two guys sort of right up the middle and then one up the seam because you're trying to run the coverage off, you know, and so getting guys to flip their hips. Because if you run a backside seam, then you can cause guys to kind of turn and then they will see a drag route or a crossing route. But if you just kind of keep them vertical against a team that likes to play a little bit more man or pattern match, then you can do things with that boundary where you can kind of bring them on a delay, drag, cross, where you're clearing that out. I mean, there's things that I think they'll do stuff like that. Are they going to put them into the boundary and say, hey, we're going to run comeback routes and back shoulders with you all day? No. Why not have Emeka and Marvin Harrison do those things? They're bigger players. But I just think, and if you're Notre Dame, you got to be prepared for that.
Right.
And if they don't do it, if they just leave them one spot, then it makes it easier for you to have at least a schematic plan for them. It doesn't make it easier to stop them. Mm-hmm. It just makes them easier to know where he is and have a plan for him. And then you got to execute in order to stop him. But that's kind of the difference.
I think you also have to mention Tariq Bracey, obviously. I think he's going to be a big player in the slot, right? Like if we see Jackson Smith and Jigba playing a ton in the slot, I anticipate that Tariq's going to have a nice game, right? Like I think he's a very important player. I mean, because we always talk about, you know, Cam Hart taking away this guy and Clarence Lewis doing a good job on the other side and Ryan Barnes doing whatever. Not many people talk about the nickel corner, though, right? And I think in this offense, when you have so many different good wide receivers, whether it's Emeka working in the slot, whether it is Jackson Smith and Jigba working in the slot, whoever it ends up being, the nickel corner, I anticipate Tariq's going to play a lot in that football game, and he needs to have a good game, in my opinion, for Notre Dame to have a realistic chance to stop that offense.
Yep. Good one. John Wayne's Winchester, Bama and Notre Dame meet in the playoffs. Will Anderson rushes against Blake Fisher, let's say 10 times. How many pancakes does Blake get? 11. I'd be happy with one or two.
Yes. Especially in pass pro, because like in run game, you're going to see a lot more pancakes.
Yeah.
You know?
But he'll get a couple. Actually, I think he'd even get more in the pass game if he were to get any. Just because wide rush, you just put him on the ground and then kind of fall on him, you know, like a wide rush. But Will Anderson doesn't get taken to the ground very often unless he wants to be on the ground. So I love the optimism, John Wayne's Winchester, but no. No. He meant to type one and he just, you know, it got stuck and put 11 on there.
Sure.
10 Day says, how many Notre Dame players have played for the Chargers? Come to Notre Dame, you'll at least get a shot with the Chargers. They went through a stretch there with their GM where they had like 9 Notre Dame kids. Like, because remember that one year they drafted Tillery and Isaac Rochelle like a couple years apart. Mm-hmm. And then they drafted like Elohi Gilman and Drew Tranquil. Yeah. And then they had signed as non-drafted free agents. They signed like Osmar Bilal, Dante Vaughn, and Tyler Newsome, you know, and then if you want to get real technical, Jalen Guyton, who started his career at Notre Dame. So it's like they had drafted Chris Watt, although it was a different regime, drafted Chris Watt. They signed Manti Te'o at one point in time. So it was like, yeah, they love some Notre Dame players, man. I don't know if the current regime is still that way, but yeah, when what's the name of their previous coach? Real good dude. He played running, but Anthony Lynn was there.
Anthony Lynn, yeah.
Yeah, that when he was there, and is it the same GM, or do they have a new GM? They had a young guy there.
It's the same. I think it's Smith, right? Last name Smith? Oh, no.
No, it was last name with a T, I believe.
I know this.
Yeah, his
– A.J. Smith, right?
He's not. Here, I'm going to pull it up.
Yeah.
Trying to see who – because I don't think it's the same guy. Yeah, it is Tom Telesco. Yeah, that's who it was.
I'm an idiot. Yeah.
AJ Smith was before that. Yeah, Tom Telesco's been there since 13. He's still the GM, but yeah, he loves drafting Notre Dame guys.
Yeah.
I just wasn't sure when they did the coaching turnover if they also did a GM turnover or not.
I should have remembered that one because Telesco was actually high school teammates or graduates in the same year with Brian Daboll, who is now the Giants head coach. And that was like the big rumor for a while. It was like, oh, he's bringing over his high school teammate or something like that. But yeah, it didn't happen.
How's Staley done so far in your view?
He is – all right, so he was a Rams defensive coordinator. He's a really sharp defensive mind. I really like him as a defensive coordinator. I'm not sold as a head coach at all. Mm-hmm. He's very analytically driven. And he
a little
does
too much?
Yeah, man. I think it was the game last year. It was like fourth down from like their own 30-yard line, fourth and three, and then he went for it, and mm-hmm. they didn't get it.
Okay.
I'm just like, that's not good situational football. Yeah. I know analytics will tell me, always go for it on fourth down, but like we know that you shouldn't always go for mm-hmm. it on fourth down. Like it's not apples to apples, but whatever.
Yep. Michael S. with a super chat. Michael says, Matt LaFleur, what was his history as a Notre Dame assistant, recruiter, QB coach? Why did he leave so quick? Was he a bust? He was here for just a year. It was 2014. And I don't think he was a bust. I mean, I think Everett Golson would have been worse if Matt LaFleur wasn't here, because he developed some really bad habits with working with George Whitfield, some really bad habits. And I think Matt LaFleur helped with that. But the reality is Matt LaFleur just was not invested in being Notre Dame. It was a one-year stop for him, and he was moving on. I think he knew it from the beginning. There's some stories about him on the recruiting trail where I heard this from a parent of a five-star kid at USC that, yeah, my kid and Rasheem Green were really interested in Notre Dame, and we had called and tried to set something up with Matt LaFleur, and he said, hey, I'll call you back with visit plans. And he's like, I never returned our call. He never called back. We tried to call. He never returned a call. And they probably still would have ended up at USC, but it's just one of those things where it's like he was here for a year, and which is fine. But you know, Kelly then let him. You know, Kelly acted like he was going to be here for longer, and so he trusted him as a recruiter and all this kind of stuff. And he didn't. He wasn't invested. But as a quarterbacks coach, I think he did a pretty good job. You know, with those guys. So, you know, we'll kind of see how that goes. But yeah, he wasn't real locked in at Notre Dame.
He was a sharp. He's a sharp offensive mind. Actually was. He was at the pro day. I remember I saw him mm-hmm. at the pro day for Notre Dame. So yeah.
Yep. Good stuff. Thank you for the super chat, Michael. Ian Johnson asks, as of now, do you think if Ohio State comes out in how Oklahoma State beat us, do you think if press man, loaded box, quick tempo, that we can deal with it? I'll ask again after fall camp is over to see any opinion changes. I don't think fall camp's going to change it a whole lot. I think that they're going to be better prepared to deal with it. Number one, you're going to have a defensive coordinator running the show that I think is a little bit more prepared to make adjustments if things aren't working or they're beating with something. And that was the thing last year, is there just were no adjustments made until late in the game when it was too late. You know, Marcus Freeman eventually stepped in, but it was too late. He gave them maybe too much time. We've explained why we think that is, talking to sources, but reality is he stepped in too late. Offensively, they tried making adjustments. There just wasn't anything that they could do about it because the offensive line and the receivers weren't prepared. So I think they'll be better prepared to deal with it, no question. And I think you have an offseason. And the other thing, too, is your struggles in that game are going to then help you be prepared for what you're going to see then, because even though it wasn't Jim Knowles running that defense, it was still his defense that they were running to a degree, you know, with their own tendencies and all that. So you're going to see that. Plus, Notre Dame had 12 full games to prepare, 13 full games to evaluate his defense last year, getting ready for one game. So you're really preparing for the same defense for two games in a row. And you've got a lot of time in those two games to prepare and watch a lot of film. So I think they'll be be in much better position to deal with it, to the point where it'll just come down to execution at that point in time and which team executes better. But I don't think we're going to look back and be like, wow, you know, Notre Dame got out schemed, you know, they got out coached. It'll just be a situation where two really good teams played and Ohio State just played better and took advantage of matchups better or whatever the case may be. Because the concerning thing for Notre Dame is you can do things to take the outside jump balls out of the way, but the Ohio State run game concerns me a lot more than the Oklahoma State run game did last year.
Sure.
And now Oklahoma State had good numbers running the ball, but a lot of that was just the quarterback scrambling. I mean, that was the big thing from last year's game, was just the quarterback scrambles were killed Notre Dame.
Wasn't Jalen Warren not playing in that game too, right? Did he play against Notre Dame? I can't remember.
I think he played. I know he missed the big.
Yeah,
he had 19 carries for 82 yards. Gotcha. So, I mean, that's barely 4 yards a carry.
Yeah.
125 of their 234 yards were Sanders. So it was scrambles.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's where a lot of their run game production came from. But yeah, that was a brutally bad performance by Notre Dame. And I'd be surprised to see him have two bad ones like that in a row.
Yeah. I don't anticipate CJ Stroud running for 125 yards against Notre Dame.
No.
Personally.
No. No, that'd be a really bad sign.
I will say, Brian, at least two out of these things I feel very confident with, just from, I mean, it all spurns off of just better coaching at the wide receiver and offensive line positions for me, right? It's because press man, I would be surprised if Notre Dame was as bad against press man this year as they were last year. I think naturally they'll be better, and that will also help with the loaded box stuff, right? If you have wide receivers who can create instant separation, you're not going to be able to load the box quite as easily as you did last year, and that's on top of Tyler Buchner being the run threat that he is, right? Like, that's going to loosen up some boxes for you as well. So I agree.
Yep. I think the tempo is the thing that I'm more concerned about, to be honest with you. Like, I do. Will they adjust well to that? That's the bigger concern that I have.
Sure.
Tom Flavin says, Brian emphasizes the importance of dudes being dudes to succeed. You're turning me into like Steve Adazio there, Tom. That was his expression, dudes being dudes. You remember that when he was a BC? He would say that, dudes being dudes. Apart from recruiting dudes, how are they developed in a football program? That's a really good question, Tom. It's a lot of different things. It's obviously the strength conditioning program is a big part of it. So that way you're maximizing a player's physical potential. There comes the point where, like, do you recruit kids that fit the scheme that you'd like to run? Because that does matter. You don't want to take a kid who, you know, if you're taking a kid whose game doesn't fit your scheme and then you're, you know, kind of tailoring the two things, it's not as simple as like, well, just fit the scheme around him. Well, what if the other 10 guys don't fit the scheme that works for that kid, right? So there's got to be some recruiting the right kind of kids to it. Assuming that they're doing that, it's then, you know, developing the technique, making kids know how to play the game, you know, physically how to play the game, how to line up, how to, you know, I mean, what makes Harry Hiestand so great, Ryan? It's not, you know, oh, he's like, he's got these really crazy complex run schemes and nobody knows how to play. No, it's his guys are fundamentally sound, tough and physical. That comes down to teaching technique, that comes down to mindset, and it comes down to your practice is designed in a way to make sure you're maximizing the opportunities to teach the things that you emphasize as a football coach. And I think the best teams in the country are those that understand that technique and talent is going to trump scheme without those two things.
Yeah.
And Alabama won, 9, 11, 12, 15. They won 17. Five of their titles and of their six titles, in my opinion, were won with very mediocre offenses in a lot of different ways, meaning they weren't the high octane 40 plus points per game, mediocre relative to what we see now. Alabama won titles where they were barely scoring more than what Notre Dame scored in 15 or 19 and 21. But what they were on offense was really efficient, well-coached, physical, and then they were the same way on defense. And I think that gets over. I actually think Alabama's been has not been coached as well last 4 or 5 years compared to where they were early, because I think their talent has actually been better in recent years. Athletically, they're in more high-octane offenses. They score a lot more points, but they're not winning as much as they did early in his career. I mean, they won 3 titles in 4 years at one point in time during his career. So, you know, I don't think they're as fundamentally sound as they've been in the past. But when they were really rolling from like 09 to 15, I thought they were a really fundamentally sound team. Really fundamentally sound team. And I think that is part of it too. And then there's things like there's the mental part of the game, you know, and it's not just learning the system. It's the deep mental, the psyche aspect of it. You know, do you have guys ready to handle adversity? I mean, if you ever talk to like a, you know, Navy SEAL, and teams will bring in Navy SEALs. Well, the whole point is of that is big training to be a SEAL is they try to break your will, your spirit, your psyche. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to do that to football players. But what you are trying to do is find ways that you can put them in situations in the classroom, in the meeting room, on the football field, in the weight room, where you are pushing them past the point that they think they're capable of getting to. And that you put them in stressful situations that they then have to show a level of ability to overcome adversity. Like, those are the things that the great coaches do. That's why Lou Holtz always played those mind games with players. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his players say, like, I didn't understand why he did that stuff when I was going through it. But now looking back as an adult, you're like, oh, I see what he's trying to do. Like, yeah. That's why we were always tougher. You know, that's why we were always more physical than the other teams. That's why we never quit. That's why we were this. That's why we're that. Because, oh, I get it now. That's why coach did that. Because there was nothing that they could throw us on Saturday, any type of adversity that we weren't going to be prepared for. And I think those are the different aspects that go into developing a player, each individual player, and then those players make up the program. Yeah. And I think the biggest thing that has hurt Notre Dame at quarterback, for example, is I think that they have not put the quarterbacks in position to thrive mentally. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even talking about executing the offense. I'm just talking about handling just every aspect of it. Like when your head coach acts the way that Brian Kelly acted towards quarterbacks so often, that they'd come off the field and Brian Kelly's telling them something, and then they'd go talk to the quarterback coach and he'd tell them something, and then they'd get on the phone to go talk to the offensive coordinator and he'd tell them something. And it was like three or different things that the quarterback was being told.
Too many voices, yeah.
Way too many. Yeah. And then when your head coach doesn't know what they're talking about and he says something to the quarterback and the OC's like, no, that's not what we're doing, that's going to create problems. I think there's like the players are not allowed to have the confidence in themselves or the system around them to play to their peak, because that's the final piece. Is there's football as much as any sport, if not more. It's like I don't like comparing it to the military a lot, because that's war, that's life and death, and football is not life and death. But there's one aspect of it there's a lot of aspects that I think do carry over in regard to the importance of the team. And you talk to anybody that served overseas, and I'm giving you my experience. I had a grandfather that fought in World War II, you know, won, like, I got his record, you know, fought in the Battle of the Bulge and earned different honors and things like that. I've relatives served in Iraq, and people in our chat that I know that served in the military that have fought overseas, right? And they'll tell you, like, when you're in it, it's about the man next to you. It's hey, I got to trust him. I got to, because my life is in his hands. His life is in my hands. And we've got to work as a team, because if one person in that team kind of goes off script, that affects all of us. Mm-hmm. I think football is very much like that. And if you don't have trust in your commanders, right? If you don't have trust that, hey, this commander, like, you ever study George Patton? It's fascinating. Like the loyalty and the trust that his troops showed in him. He could say, go do this really bizarre thing, and they would do it and just know that it was going to work because they trusted the old man, right? Yeah. Right. And sometimes maybe it wasn't the best strategy, but they carried it out as if they just knew and it would work. And football is that way as well. You got to trust the man next to you. That's cultivated through your training. That's cultivated mm-hmm. through the mental and physical deals that you go through in practice and preparation, getting up before the sun's up, and you're done when the sun's down, you know, and all those type of things. But then also trusting your captains, your generals, your lieutenants, who are the quarterback coach, the receivers coach, the offensive coordinator, the head coach. And if there's not faith in all aspects of that, you're not going to be the best team you can be.
Right.
And I think that's the part that I think has been missing a lot for Notre Dame in recent seasons. So I hope that answers that question. Anything you'd like to add to that? Right.
No, I was just going to say, for the coaching aspect of everything, I love that you're kind of like talking about cultivating the mental side and the physical mm-hmm. side equally. But I also think that sometimes coaches can kind of get in their own way and not letting dudes be dudes, right? Like, you have mm-hmm. to really, I think, to be a great coach, you also need to understand a player's strengths mm-hmm. fully, right? And ask him to do things that not only are they comfortable with, but that they excel at, right? Like, mm-hmm. so don't hamstring a player. Don't try to fit a square peg into a round hole. Get out of your way and let dudes be dudes, because there might be some things that they do that maybe aren't even structurally the most sound thing sometimes, but like, it's like having a great safety that, you know, is a little bit of a freelancer, but you're trying to be like, nope, you need to do this and that, and that's all you do. And you're actually hamstringing them. Like, you're limiting the impact that he can do in that regard, right? So, I mean, to your point, I think that the coaching side is as important as just the athlete in general. Right. His ability to take what they do well and allow them to do it. Don't get in your own way when you're a coach sometimes.
Yep. Really good question, Tom. Really good question. John A1 with a question. John asks, how does Audric Estime compare to Willis McGahee? Similar frame, right? Both have good feet and flexibility and speed to beat linebackers to the edge. I think McGahee had a better initial burst. And then John had a little bit more to that. Let me get to the rest of his comment here, if I can find it. I do not see the rest of his comment. He said a little bit more burst. I don't see what else John added to that. But there were some people in the chat saying, like, if not for that devastating injury he suffered against Ohio State in the championship game, that he'd have had a better career. I still can't believe that he came back and even played in the NFL after that injury. But he was a good player.
He was still a first round pick after that too, man. And he was a good player early on, you know, with the Bills, and then he went to the Ravens, and he was a pretty good player still. But that's an interesting comp, John, because I do agree that from a body type perspective, pretty similar looking athletes. I would agree with you, though. I think that Willis had a little more vertical burst, especially early on in reps. Like Willis McGahee before that injury, especially, and even into his NFL career as he got like more healthy, my guy could move.
Dude had 4,000-yard seasons in the NFL. That's nuts for the when you consider the injury he sustained.
Oh, that injury was gruesome, man. It was absolutely gruesome. I made my wife watch that one time, Brian, like when we first met, and she's like, don't ever make me watch that again in my entire life. I'm like, yeah, it was gruesome, man, but – I mean, he was a special athlete at Miami and a really good, still a really good NFL player for what he was dealt.
Similar traits, a lot of similar traits, but yes, it just some guys are very similar traits wise. Other guys, just he's just better at those traits. And as of right now, that's what we see from Willis McGahee. Aldrich has to show that, but he's a very good football player. Mm-hmm. John A1 also says, why does Riley Mills project better on the out? This is a really good question. Why does Riley Mills project better on the outside? Does he play with strong hands? Is there anything you can point to as to why, now that he's put on 30 pounds since arriving, could he be better inside now? Take first crack at that.
Yeah, I think he could be, John, I think that he could be a substantial, productive player at either spot, if I'm being honest. Why I think it's better for Riley is I think Riley is more of a block defeater with his flexibility and ability to kind of contort his body in different ways. I don't think he's the most – I think he has powerful hands, but I think it's different when you're working inside trying to work against multiple blocks and combos and that type of thing, right? So I think he's more of a slipper. So, like, if he's a three tech and you're just asking him to purely – you know, just shoot one gap and to just use his flexibility in that regard. Mm-hmm. I think he could be a really good player in that department. But I think for me, Brian, I think his style is just a little more finesse than it is aggressive, just a little bit. So I think that it's working outside in might be a better option for him than inside out.
I would disagree with the notion of it being finesse. Mm-hmm. I would say, I think we're probably saying the same thing. I would say it differently. Just because when I hear finesse, I don't want to hear that about a lineman. I think Riley's style and just is I want to get around you as opposed to standing there. I want to be going forward. And I think there comes a point in time too, Ryan, where defensive linemen are a lot like offensive linemen. Some guys are just more comfortable in space. Some guys are just more comfortable in short areas. Riley's a really long athlete.
Yes.
And I don't think he's really comfortable inside as much where everything is happening so quickly. Mm-hmm. And really long athlete, and not just long as an arm length, because Jason Adamuola, I think, has some pretty long arms, but also long in that he's really high cut. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of his body type just fits better out, at least for him, and he's more comfortable outside. I think he's a guy that also just, again, likes to use his hands to do moves, and I think he's just more comfortable on the edge. I also think his athleticism fits there. I think the thing that, when I look at Riley Mills, I say this about all types of different positions. Stop talking to me about what a guy's size is. Talk to me about, can he play at that size? Mm-hmm. Well, this guy's going to outgrow the linebacker. What does that mean? Well, he's going to be 250 pounds. So is Leo Chanel. Right. That guy was a freaking linebacker. You know what I mean? Like
the monster.
Right. It's not about outgrowing it. Are you, unless the outgrowing also comes with a loss of athletic talent, right? Sure. Well, that guy's going to be 225 pounds. He's going to outgrow safety. Not necessarily. Can he still move? Can he still run? Can he still change direction the same way he did before? then okay, then he's not going to outgrow it. And I think that's the thing is we look at just weight and say, okay, 6'5", 293, that's an inside guy. That's not how he plays, though. I think he just plays, I think his cut, I think his comfort level, I think the things he likes to do that he's comfortable with his own game are things that progress to me or project to me more as an outside guy. And I think he could be a good inside player, but I just feel like what we've seen of him, he just looks more comfortable outside. So I don't think there's a wrong answer on where he plays from a skill set standpoint. I think part of it is just where's he most comfortable. We see this at receiver, Ryan. Guys that maybe are built like outside guys just seem more comfortable inside. Guys that are seem like they should be inside guys because of their size are really good outside because they're just more comfortable out there.
Right.
And, you know, like Steve Smith is, like body type-wise, is the prototype slot receiver. But Steve Smith's an outside receiver. Why? Because he just – his game fits that. Even though his body doesn't fit it, his game fit it.
Antonio Brown played outside mostly too.
Yeah. Who's, again, another guy that's not like built like your typical, you know, your stereotypical outside receiver. Right. Does T.Y. Hilton play – did he play a lot outside or was he more of a slot guy?
No, no, he's more an outside guy because they like to stretch it vertically.
Because he's another small guy that you would think – but his game projects outside, right? So I think that's the same. It's the same thing with defensive linemen. But, John, great question. And, by the way, I just noticed your avatar's got the IB thing on the logo. That's flipping awesome, man.
Oh, I didn't even see that.
Yeah, I just noticed that. I was like, what is that? That's awesome. I love that. Love that. Tommy Gunn says, B. Ryan, I decided to start my Trekkie journey and just finished Star Wars Episode 5. Which movie or spinoff is your favorite? Can you rank how you like them? Is this just of the Star Treks? Star Wars?
He said he started his Trekkie journey and just finished episode. Wait, so are we doing Star Trek and Star Wars together? Is that what's happening?
I have no idea. Isn't this a conversation that you and Vince had?
Yeah, we're talking a lot about Star Wars.
Yeah, I never watched Star Trek, so I couldn't.
I didn't watch Star Trek either. My brother-in-law actually makes fun of me because he says Star Trek is better than Star Wars, and I say that Star Wars is better, even though I've never actually seen Star Trek. But it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I wasn't a big fan of Star Trek, but it just, I'll tell you what, I did like the new Star Treks with Chris Pine. I'm not going to lie to you. I did like those. I liked those better than the previous ones. But because I watched the Star Treks when I was younger, because my dad, we would go to the movies and watch the movies. I didn't watch the TV series.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously the originals are great. Of the three, the prequels kind of thing, I thought those were bad. I didn't like any of them. Although I thought Qui-Gon Jinn was a bad dude. Like Liam Neeson rocked that character, man.
I love Liam Neeson, man.
But overall, they just were bad. Great graphics, right? And the storylines were just kind of blah. And Hayden Christensen is just
you know what Natalie Christensen?
No, not in that role. Then Hayden, the worst one, Natalie Portman's she was just way over too dramatic and just.
I didn't love her. Ewan McGregor's my guy though.
Yes, he was that the Obi-Wan could like there were characters I liked.
Sure,
but the movies I didn't like. I liked Qui-Gon Jinn. I liked Ewan McGregor's Obi-Wan Kenobi. But yeah, just some of the stuff on there was just like this is really lame.
What's your opinion on Jar Jar Binks? Are you a fan?
Oh God, no. That whole thing was just so dumb. Like, stupid. You know.
The best fan theory I've ever saw is, I'm not trying to spoil anything if you haven't seen the newest three, like the three after the originals. So there was a fan theory that the one bad guy in the new sequence was actually Jar Jar Binks resurrected
or something. Oh, the Snape guy or whatever it was?
Yeah, yeah, whatever. A Snook or whatever.
Snoke, right?
General Snoke. Someone said that was going to be Jar Jar Binks in the end, which would have been great.
Whatever. Whatever. The new ones were good. You know, they were good. They weren't bad. They were great. The first couple were better.
I liked the first one, and then the last two, they lost me.
Yeah.
They lost me in the last two, yeah.
Yeah, just like that whole weird thing between Rey and Han Solo's kid, Kylo Ren, was just kind of weird and just like forced. But the action was good. Yeah.
I also really like Adam Driver as an actor, but I hated him as Kylo Ren. Like, he's just not good. It wasn't his fault. They just made that character so bad.
Like, they did. I didn't think the writing on the last two was very good, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
you know, so it was. Yeah, it was kind of weird. And didn't Carrie Fisher die before the last one?
Yes.
Right? Didn't she? Okay, because she was supposed to be in the last one, right?
She was still in it. They like messed, you know, they made it that way or whatever. But yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she was supposed to have a bigger role in the last one, I think. Yep. But just some of the character development was really bad in the last two, and they just like there were storylines that started, but they didn't finish. Like I just thought the first three, it was all woven together so well. Yeah, and I just never felt the. Like, I actually think the story arc was more consistent in the prequels than it was in the last three. I just think the acting, the characters were better in the last three, in my opinion.
Yeah. It was, I was also let down by a lot of like the character development. I would agree on like the last three because like I was like, after the first one, I was like, man, I really am so interested to see what Rey's origin are. And then I was just like, at the end, I'm just like, oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
They never took it to where I thought they were going to take it. Right.
Ever. Yeah. And they had many possibilities, man. Yeah. Endless possibilities.
Yeah. They got lazy with it. And I didn't love how they had, I just didn't love Luke Skywalker's character in the last.
They turned him from a hero into a dud. Very
a whiny little yes.
Yeah.
Very and it's hard to have, you know, sequels. That's what I found so fascinating about the Lord of the Rings and why I will not watch the Rings of Power that just came out on Prime or whatever.
Yeah.
Because that's the one series, and there's been a few, but that's to me the best one ever. That and I'll say the Harry Potters I thought really did a good job too.
They did a good job
getting better. Mm-hmm. But the Lord of the Rings got better every time.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one was good. It's a little long, but it was long because they did so much good character development in the first one.
Yep.
And then it just let the storylines and the action were really good in the last two. So I thought that was one of the few that actually got better.
It's so easy to tell if a movie's going to be good or not for me nowadays, because if it's below 2 hours, I'm like, that's not going to have enough character development.
Yeah.
Like every time they try to do the Suicide Squad thing. Right. And I'm just like, oh, that sounds cool in theory. Like I would like that. And then I'm like, oh, it's an hour and 50 minutes. Like,
have you ever seen them remake a movie more times with different characters than in a short period of time than Suicide Squad? Like, don't they normally like wait 20 years to redo a movie with different characters?
Man, they just haven't done it well, man. They just can't do it. It's like the Incredible Hulk. Like, they really just haven't done it well.
They have not done the standalone Hulk very well at all. Yes, and then they wasted him in Endgame. Was completely wasted in Endgame. Like, they made him lame.
Professor Hulk.
They made him so lame in Endgame.
They did.
Yeah. So lame.
When he couldn't, like, it wasn't great. Yeah, it wasn't great. Lame. I'll say another series of movies that I thought got at least the same, but maybe better. Toy Story was an awesome series of movies. Awesome series. Yes. Okay. I know this because I've been watching it with Juliet the last 2 weeks.
Okay, there you go. There you go.
Fantastic.
The original, like the old ones, like the Tom Hanks.
Toy Story 1. Very Story cool. 4 wasn't the best, but the first three were fantastic. Awesome.
Milton Fan 15 says, does Tommy Rees deserve most of the blame for lack of quarterback development and so many quarterbacks transferring in past years, or does BK? He deserves some for the transfers. And the only transfer I would give him some blame for is Phil Dracovic. Mm-hmm. But I also kind of give him a little bit of a pass because that was his first year as a full-time coach. Remember, he's a GA the year before, even though he's a full-time guy. I think Tommy has learned some things since then. Brendan Clark transferred because he was barren on the depth chart. I don't fault Tommy Rees for that. I mean, that's just the reality of it. But I think one of the misconceptions is I actually think Coach Rees did a good job with Ian Book and Jack Cohn, to be honest with you. I think there was not a lot Tommy Rees could do to make Ian Book any better than he was. I don't think Ian had it in him. Sean Payton couldn't get it out of him. I mean, you know, Sean Payton couldn't get him to throw the ball down the field either. And if Sean Payton can't do it, I'm not going to hold 28-year-old Tommy Rees to that, you know, saying I think he got a – because I think what he did a good job of is he did a good job of getting Ian in situations where he just, okay, I know this is who he is. And one thing I think Coach Long in 2019 kept trying to get Ian back to being the guy he was in 2018. And just never happened. I think when Coach Rees took over in 2020, and I don't blame Coach Long for that because, again, we've seen him do it. Why can't he get back to it? And I think a lot of that was with Brian Kelly and just the way that Brian Kelly handled Ian and coached Ian. And I just don't think, you know, then getting rid of Chip Long and all types of mess that I think were more about Brian Kelly. I think what Tommy Rees did a good job of in 2020 is I know who Ian is. I'm not going to ask him to do things that I know he won't do. I'm not going to keep calling a bunch of post routes and hoping he'll finally throw it. You know, and what's the one post route that he hit? It was an inside post route against Clemson to Avery Davis. Mm-hmm. And even there were still times where, you know, Tommy still didn't pull the trigger when he should have. But I think for the most part, he did a good job of getting the most out of Tommy Rees or out of Ian Book. And then same thing with Jack Cohn is, you know, I thought Jack did a nice job of adapting to the shotgun as the season went on last year and finished the season on a pretty hot note. And once once he got some semblance of mediocre offensive line play, and again, a lot of it had to do with the fact they're playing bad D lines, Jack was really good. Mm-hmm. I mean, really good. I mean, Jack's numbers down the stretch were really impressive. And if you expand them over the course of a whole season, he would have had a really impressive season last year. And so I think Coach Rees gets a lot of credit for that. I mean, you know, again, guy completed 65.5% of his passes, you know, starting with he came off the bench, did a great job, or got benched and came back off the bench against Virginia Tech, led him to a victory. And he kind of woke up after that. He was 71.4% the next week, 66.7% against North Carolina with a couple drops, bad drops, 79.3% against Navy, 75% against Virginia and Georgia Tech, 74.3% against Stanford, 55.9% against Oklahoma State with several drops, but he threw for 509 yards.
Yeah.
In his last three games, he threw for 285, 345, and 509, and threw 9 touchdowns in 3 games. So I think that's the Jack Cohn that we always thought we were going to get. And we saw it against Florida State too. It's just the stuff in between, to me, that wasn't on Jack Cohn. That was more about what was around him. And I think Tommy did a good job taking a guy who had always been an under-center, play-action pass quarterback and turning him into a shotgun quarterback where he's got to get rid of the ball quickly. I thought he did a pretty nice job of evolving him. Now, will he be able to do that with Tyler Buchner? That's ultimately what he's going to be judged on.
Yeah.
So I just think most of those issues had to do with BK because, as we've talked about this before, there's way too many voices there. And one of those loudest voices that everybody had to listen to was not always on top of what they were trying to do offensively. Mm-hmm. And that creates big problems. That's gone now. And Marcus Freeman has made clear, like, when I talk to the quarterback, it's in a completely different type of talking. It's about him being the leader. It's about him being, you know, that type of thing. Hey, you know, encouragement, stuff like that. It's not, hey, man, you should have hit this route on this play. It's like, well, that's not the read, coach. You know, and you know, that kind of stuff's not going to be happening with Marcus Freeman. I don't believe, based on what he has said and what we've been told. But at this point in time, that's why this year is going to be so important. Because you can't use Brian Kelly as an excuse anymore. It's now on Tommy, and that's also partly why I'm optimistic about how things are going to go this year.
Love it.
So here we go. Omar Austin kind of asking a question about our original topic. Is the Nicholas Harbor kid from Maryland the freakiest 2023 recruit? And it's not even close.
It's not even close, Omar. The kid is – if you haven't watched Nicholas Harbor, he's a very raw football player. But my man is 6'5", 220, 10'2", 800 meter, I think. So he's flying, sub-21 in the 200. Like, this kid, if he wanted to just maintain this weight or even cut a little bit of weight, he probably could be an Olympic runner. Like, that's what type of player he is. But he's probably going to continue to get bigger, whether he's a tight end at the next level, wide receiver, defensive end, linebacker, whatever he ends up playing. Yes, he is a freaky, freaky athlete, no doubt.
So on the message board later today, I'm going to be dropping my top 100 for the year. And Ryan and I have kind of gone over it. I've made a couple changes on it based on some of the conversations we've had. I've got Harbor number 6. Yeah. And that could be considered high because of how raw he is. But he's so athletic that he doesn't have to be the most fundamentally sound player. And he can he could play safety. I mean, that's how athletic he'd be at the most athletic safety in the country. He's built like a defensive end. I mean, he is a freak. And if it wasn't for him, people would be talking a lot more about Samuel Mpemba being a freak. But because Samuel Mpemba just can't – is not in the same league as Nicholas Harbor, because nobody is, he is without question the biggest freak in this class. There's three guys that just – when I think of this class, four guys off the top of my head are just freaky athletically. And Nicholas Harbor's one, Keon Keeley's two, Caleb Downs is one, and then Zachariah Branch, the kid going to USC, is another.
Kid special,
he is a crazy fast, explosive kid. Mm-hmm. So, and he will be my my number two receiver in the class, and he's a top 10 guy as well. So just a little teaser on that one.
You want to talk about generational type of athletes, though? I mean, who's been more impressive to come out of high school than Nicholas Harbor in recent memory? Like that kid, I mean, 6'5", 220 with 10 200-meter speed. Yeah. Like that is nuts, man. That is
insane. I'd be fired up about that if it was a 5'10", 175-pound guy.
Right. Because you're like, wow, there's my deep threat for the next X amount of years. Like, it's insane, man. I got a tip on him from a guy that does like has an analytics company. He's like, oh, you need to watch this kid. Like before mm-hmm. he even like blew up. And I'm like, what the heck, man? Like he's literally one of those kids that could be a number one overall pick one day if he puts mm-hmm. it together. Like he's that type of athlete. It's silly type of athlete.
Let's go to Josh Buffo, the motivational business banker. Would Tony Rice be in your top five Notre Dame players of all time based on his natty and his record against ranked teams in a span of 2 years? What say you guys? Top five Notre Dame players of all time. So again, I'm going to always preface this. I will never do a top five Notre Dame players of all time. I can't. I never saw Ross Browner play. I never saw Luther Bradley. I never saw Leon Hart. I never saw Paul Herning. I never saw John Hewitt. I never saw Angelo Bertelli. I never saw George Gipp. I cannot possibly, because then I'm just comparing statistics, which is also unfair because it's different eras. So I will only ever give a list of guys from my lifetime. And in my lifetime, Tony Rice is in my top five. No doubt about it. Just because it's not just that he was a winner, because again, that can be inflated. You know, you're all part of a good team, but he was a key part in a lot of those wins, number one. And he was a dynamic player that you had to always be prepared for. You couldn't put your emphasis on Ricky Waters and Rocket Ismail and these other guys because if you did, he would burn you. And we saw that against USC. They were so worried about the pitch that allowed Tony to just kind of sneak in and just rip off an option run for a big play. And he was always best in the big games. I mean, he was great in the big games. And the other day I was watching the Orange Bowl against Colorado that last year where they played number one Colorado. And beat him 21-6, and he was just so dynamic, and you just had to handle him. His numbers weren't sexy, but he was a dynamic player. The funny thing is, two of the five of my top five played together, and that's Rocket and Tony Rice.
Do you know who your top five would definitely be? Do you have it like
off top of my head? And again, I reserve the right to go back and change it. So these are not the top five most talented players, but just the best.
Sure.
And I kind of go from like 88 to now.
Okay.
You know, I think you have to go Tony Rice and Rocket Ismail for me.
Okay.
Bryant Young, Quentin Nelson, and Manti Te'o are my five. Yeah, that'd be my five. Yeah. And I mean, I'm leaving off some stars. I'm leaving off
Jalen
Smith, Todd Light. Jalen Smith was the most physically gifted player, but Jalen Smith wasn't allowed to be the player he could have been.
Right.
That's the difference. Like if he would have played for Mike Elkler or Clark Lee, he's number one on my list. Because he was still pretty good. It's just he was not allowed to fully maximize his talent at Notre Dame. So I can't look at him and say, I mean, the guy never had as many tackles for loss in a season as Asmar Bilal. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's not his fault, but that's what I'm judging on, right? And so he's not in – he's number one if we're talking about who's the most talented offense, you know, players. You know, I'm leaving off Aaron Taylor. I'm leaving off Reggie Brooks. I'm leaving off Jerome Bettis.
Right.
You know, now – Jerome became a great player, and Jerome was really good. But I mean, Jerome wasn't even the leading rusher on his team in his last year. Reggie Brooks was, you know, and so it's a very subjective list. Did I say Brady Quinn? I didn't even say Brady Quinn on my list. You know, so Brady, there's a lot of guys. Jeff Samars is not on that list. Tyler Eifert's not on that list. Ronnie Stanley's not on that list. I mean, there's some great players not on that list, which is kind of what makes it fun. But, yeah, those would be my five. So Tony Rice, Rocket Ismail, Bryant Young, Quentin Nelson, and Manti Te'o were my five.
So love it.
Curious what some other people kind of think were that. Like Justin, somebody said Justin Tuck. He had one good year. I mean, really. You know what I mean? Like he was kind of a rotational guy. I'll say this to Lance's comment about Justin Tuck. If Justin Tuck would have come back in 05, there's a good chance he's on that list.
Yeah.
Because that team would have – I still say that team could have played for a title if Justin Tuck would have come back. Mm-hmm. They'd have beat USC because you'd have had him rushing off the edge instead of Ronald Talley against on 4th and 9. You know what I mean? So he was a great player.
sure was.
Somebody said Tim Brown. I didn't really know. I was 10 and 88. That was really the first year that I had a full recollection of that team. And the reason a lot of the guys I talk about from the 88 team are guys that also played in 89 and 90, you know, like Tony Rice and then Rocket and Ricky Waters. I don't talk as much about Frank Stams or Wes Pritchett or guys like that because I didn't see them as much in, as I was kind of forming that. So, like, Tim Brown, I don't really remember him as much in college, mm-hmm. so I can't say him. Now, if you're just going to talk about, like, recognition and greatness, sure, I'm sure there's a lot of people in the top five. It's just that was just slightly before my time. There's also a lot more film available of the 88 and 89 team.
Yeah,
that I've been able to go back and watch. There's not as much of it of the 87 team to be able to look at Tim Brown. And 86 and 87 are really good. He just obviously won the Heisman in 87. So that's why Tim Brown's not on my list. I just haven't seen enough of him to be able to do that. And Brady Quinn could potentially be on that list, but Brady had two pretty bad years. Again, not his fault. He had two pretty bad years, which kind of balances it. And as great as he was, like to me, Bryant Young was just a phenomenal player his whole career. You know,
every step of the way, even to the Hall of Fame.
If somebody's going to put Brady Quinn on the list, I'm not arguing with you. If you want to put Jerome Bettis on the list, I'm not arguing with you. If you want to put Reggie Brooks on the list because you thought his 1 year was good enough, I'm not going to argue with you. There's guys you could put on the list that I've had people argue that Julius Jones should be on the list. He had a great single season, but he's not on my list. I mean, there's a lot of Samardzija. I mean, Golden Tate had crazy numbers at Notre Dame. Michael Floyd, you know, finished his career owning every single receiving record at Notre Dame. Yep. You know, there's a lot of guys you could have on the list, but that's what makes it fun. But that's the era I grew up in is I left Todd Light off the list. Now, he's probably my top five of favorite players, but five best, you know, again, I would have loved to have seen Todd Light play in the modern era. I think his numbers in the modern era would be nuts. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they'd be absolutely nuts. And did you give your five, Ryan?
I did not. So I'm in the same boat as you where my early recollection is like late 90s, early 2000s. So like I'm not going to use any like the early 90s players as well, right? So top five that I remember vividly would be some combination of Quentin Nelson, Brady Quinn, Justin Tuck, Jeff Samardzija, and Monty Teo. He'd be number five. Well, he would be in the top five. He'd probably be higher than five, but
I mean, the guy's a linebacker that finished second in the Heisman Trophy, and that was his least productive year from a tackle standpoint at Notre Dame.
I know, but seven interceptions will do that for you.
Oh, he was great that year. It just goes to show how productive he was in previous years. I mean, he had 113 tackles that year and had 5.5 tackles for loss, 1.5 sacks, 7 interceptions. 2011, he had 128 tackles, 13.5 tackles for loss, and 5 sacks. 2010, he had 129 tackles, 8.5 tackles for loss, and a sack. And then as a true freshman, he had 63 tackles and 5.5 tackles for loss. Manti was an incredible player at Notre Dame. He just played on some bad teams at times until his last year. And then a lot of people I still think hold against him sort of – he was not good against Alabama, and then the whole thing with
Girlfriend thing.
You know what? It is what it is. It does not take away from the player he was. Mm-hmm. You know, he was phenomenal. He was a phenomenal player at Notre Dame.
Sure was.
Jonathan Garbick, do you guys think NFL – I'm going to let you answer this, Ryan. Do you guys think NFL and NCAA recruit that draft put too much emphasis on freak athletes, even though they might not actually be the best football players, NFL especially, in my opinion?
At times, yeah, Jonathan. I mean, it happens. That's why people miss in the draft space, right? Like there's some players who are not tremendous athletes who are just really good football players, and you can't quantify them with a 40 time or a 3-cone or whatever it might be. But I'll also say – that part of projecting for NFL and recruiting side of things is to project what a player can be, right? And to project what a player can be, traits are important.
Right.
The physical side of the game does matter. So I think it's a steady balance. But yes, there are some times where you overvalue players that are pure athletes because you think that you can get the most out of them, but they're not natural football players. It absolutely can happen, but it's a tough balancing act, if we're being completely honest.
Well, and that's what we talked about Nicholas Harbor earlier, right? I mean, you're talking about from a recruiting standpoint, I am going to give more benefit of the doubt to the traits with a high school kid than if I was an NFL team, Because I think by the time a guy's going to the draft, you kind of know what kind of player he is. If he hasn't figured out how to play football by then, you know, like the perfect example, you know, growing up, it was always Mike Mamula, right? But I think the better example in recent years is the kid from UConn that went in the second round. He was not a very good football player at all. Yeah. He was not a good football player. But he goes in the second round. Why? Because he had insane combine numbers.
Yes.
Because, hey, we can teach him how to play football. That's true of a 17-year-old like Nicholas Harbor, who shows some instincts as a football player. He's fundamentally unsound because he plays all over the place, but he shows instincts as a football player. That's the difference. It's not just athletic. And I think that's a trait. And I think the trait that I think people miss on most from a recruiting standpoint is size. And we've talked about this, Ryan. I think people put way too much on big, dominant high school players.
Yeah.
And overlook bad feet, stiff hips, things like that, because, man, you see how powerful he is. He's going against 225-pound kids. Guess what? He ain't going against 225-pound kids, and sometimes even smaller in college. Can't move his feet, and he's tight-hipped. He can't do this in the next level. Like, there's some guys I've seen ranked in the top 100 as offensive line. I'm like, that guy's not even top 300 player. Baby, so physical. Yeah, but he can't move. And college is just going to run right at him, you know, like they do in high school. He's going to have to move. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, I'm thinking about Keon Keeley or Jason Moore or Damon Wilson going against this kid, and they're going to have five flipping sacks, you know, because this kid can't get out of stance.
Yeah.
You know, but he's big and physical and mauling. And I'm like, oh, you know. And there's even some guys I have ranked high that I just don't feel comfortable with. Like, I have the kid, what's his name? Francis Maigoa. I have him ranked in the top 20, and I'm struggling with that one, right? Because he's really dominant. I think he's more athletic, but I'm projecting him to guard. And that's kind of where I feel more comfortable having him there. But even there, I'm just like, I don't know, man. Like, I don't feel great about that one because I worry that what I'm seeing is like, is he able to get away with things in high school because he's so big? Now, the thing that I do like about him is he does play against really good competition, so he has been challenged. I've seen film of him going against Jordan Hall and Samuel Mpemba and some of the kids they had last year, and he's winning reps and dominating. So it makes me feel a little better about it. But, like, he's an example of someone who I even am aware of the potential that I could miss on this one because he's so big and strong. I think in the NFL they do put too much emphasis on, like, combine stuff. And still, to this day, it blows my mind. To this day, it still happens, which just kind of is like, why? You know, why does it keep happening?
I think the first recruit we ever talked about, Brian, and this was before I even started working here, was Zach Rice in last year's class, right? Yeah. I was, like, the same way. I'm just like, he doesn't have very much flexibility to him, right? Like, he's just bullying guys. Like, we'll see how he does at North Carolina. Like, I hope he does really well. But, like, I was like, is that a top 10 player? Like, no. I don't know if I see that, man.
Because he was big and strong and physical, but he just couldn't move laterally at all.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Brandon Plesser with a question. How does the broad jump translate to on-field performance exactly? Briefly, it doesn't translate directly to on-field performance. Like, hey, if you do a good broad jump, you're going to be a great post-curl runner.
Right.
But it does translate to other aspects that make it important, right?
Brandon, I've had someone ask me this before, and someone asked, what combine test best exemplifies projection to the next level? And my answer is broad jump, because I think that you can get a lot of explosiveness out of that drill, and you can see kind of the explosiveness through the hips. And I think that really, like, a 40 time for offensive linemen doesn't really matter when you really think about it, right? There are other drills that they do, and I'm just like, that doesn't matter. Like, I don't care how much a cornerback benches, for instance, right? But broad jump, I think that can translate to multiple positions, because no matter what position you play, you need to be explosive, right? Like, whether you're an offensive lineman, whether you're running back, whether you're wide receiver, whether you're corner, you need to be explosive. And I believe that the broad jump does exemplify that. Sometimes vertical jump does not do that because there's gravity at some points, right? It's like a guy jumps high, but a guy's a heavier weight. They're not going to jump as high personally, right? But for a broad jump, I think explosiveness can be very telling for NFL success and from, I mean, just success on any level, to be honest. So I actually think the broad jump does matter a lot when I'm talking about like verification stuff for testing. That's like my first thing. I'm just like, I want to know what their broad jump was, because I think that can tell a lot about their athleticism.
And that's what a lot of that testing is supposed to do. It's about functional strength and functional athleticism. And then you translate that athleticism to things that you would ask him to do. But I also think that the best way to do it is where I think a lot of scouts go wrong is they focus so much on the combination of the numbers and don't put enough on some of the drill work. I mean, we've seen this before where guys have great numbers and you get them out in the drill work and they're stiff and they're tight and they don't look great actually going through the football drills. But the problem is you can't really test those things. I wish they would. I wish they would do more of that stuff. I wish they would create more football-specific drills that translate to it. You know, like time a guy, you know, his pedal, open, plant, run. Like time that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, why not? You time everything else. Well, I mean,
because people are so lazy because they have decades of data on like right. what a fast 40 time is. So sure. They're like, I don't want to redo that. You know, sure. It's very lazy. It sure. is very lazy. Right. There's no doubt.
So I would love to see like 40 time. I would completely scrap the 40 yard dash for me in the way it is now. I don't care. Like, okay, the 40 yard dash getting into a 3-point stance mattered back in the 1970s when receivers got into 3-point stances.
Sure.
Right. Like Notre Dame in 1988, Rocket Ismail's in a 3-point stance. Right. Okay. He's not going to be in a 3-point stance now. So you're not get him in their specific position that they play in football. Right. Like what I want to see from an offensive lineman is I want to see him in a pass set and I want to see him or a run set. Right. Now they may be in a 3-point stance. That's one where I actually get the 3-point stance.
Yeah.
Right. I don't need to see a running back in a 3-point stance. When is a running back ever going to be in a 3-point stance? When is a linebacker ever going to be in a 3-point stance? When's a corner ever going to be in a 3-point stance? Never. You know, get them in their corner stance and then have them, you know, or here's an even better one. What I would do with corners is I would have them stand there, turn, flip their hips and then run. Right. Isn't that a better gauge for how it would translate to the football field? Like, that's how you really, does this guy really have closing speed? You know, or do like a 3-step pedal, open and run and then time that. Like, I would much rather see that stuff than like football. Like, but here's who is in the 3-point stance, defensive lineman, offensive lineman. And some tight ends. Like I'd put Michael Mayer in a 3-point stance. I would have not wasted my time putting Kyle Pitts in a 3-point stance. Put receivers in a receiver stance. Get in your stance. And then run. Right? And then I don't care about the false starts. Because you know what? Guys fall. That's the other thing that drives me nuts. The false start stuff, do it again. Yeah. Why? Because if a guy false starts all the time, I need to know that as an evaluator. This guy freaking has really bad technique out of a stance. I should probably know that. That's why his time wasn't good. So that's one of the things I don't like about the combine is like, you know, but that's why people miss so much on these guys is because the drills are like not really specific to football. Like Ronnie Stanley had a bad combine, really bad combine. Has anyone ever like his athletic numbers of the combine were bad, like bad. But has anybody ever questioned Ronnie Stanley athletically as a football player? No. And that's why I say like, and kudos to the Ravens for not doing that, which is why the Ravens have always tended to be a pretty good franchise.
Too much information makes guys miss.
Yeah.
And I will always stand by that.
Was Ozzie still the GM there then?
Yeah, he should have.
His last pick was Lamar, wasn't it?
I think so. Yeah. Now it's DaCosta, who's actually done a pretty good job.
So, yeah. Well, so, I mean, that would make sense because Ozzie's a football guy. He was a football player. He was a great football player in the NFL and in college. So,
Brian, I was joking with you on the phone earlier, but I'm so serious that I'm going to see a mock draft here soon where Mozzie Smith is in the first round.
Yeah.
I'm just like, well, based on what? What are we basing that on? You're supposedly a great tester. Like, okay.
Yep.
All right.
Yep. Just,
it's how guys miss, man. Too much information sometimes makes people miss. There's no doubt.
Here we go. We got a few more before we wrap up here. Jacob Watson says, what do you think Notre Dame has to do to beat Ohio State? Do you think that they can? Let's answer the second part first. Absolutely, they can.
Agree.
Will they? That's a completely different story. But Ryan, why don't you go ahead and take a crack at what they need to do? Just kind of big picture, what are the things that Notre Dame needs to do on both, on all three phases of the game to win this?
I think Notre Dame, to beat Ohio State, needs to score more points than Ohio State's.
I'm just kidding.
Look, I think, Jacob, for me, it's that you know where your strengths are as a football team. I'm sorry. You know where your strengths are as a football team, right? You should be able to have advantages on both sides of the trenches, in my opinion, right? Like, your offensive line should have some advantage against the defensive line, unless the defensive line takes a massive step forward. And I think your defensive line definitely has advantage based on last year's film for what Ohio State has coming back on the offensive line. So I think that that's where your strength is. So what am I going to do? I'm going to work to that strength, right? Like, I'm going to say, defensive line, you guys got to be dudes, man. And you have to be able to get home with four. Offensive wise, you have to be able to push them around a little bit. And you have to be able to dictate you have to work at your own pace, right? And I don't care if that pace is slow. I don't care if you're working fast at times. Doesn't matter. All I know is that you need to be able to run the football. You need to keep the clock on your side. Those are the biggest advantages that you have as a football team, in my opinion, over in Ohio State. The other thing is that you need to limit their playmakers. Everybody knows that they have dudes everywhere. Travion Henderson, Jaxon Smith-Njigba, Marvin Harrison Jr., fantastic skill position players. You have to limit how effective they are. You're not going to ever shut them all the way out, right? But you have to limit what they do. And that makes them successful. And offensively and defensively, you need to dominate in the trenches. That is the spot where I need you to have an advantage in order to win this football game. Not even an advantage. Like, you need to dominate. Not just be good. Not just be a little bit better than Ohio State. You need to be significantly better on both sides of the ball in the front line, for in my opinion.
I will – the only part of that I'll disagree with is I don't think Notre Dame needs to significantly dominate the Ohio State defensive line or offensive line. They just need to win that battle. Because to win that battle, Notre Dame is good enough a quarterback and running back receiver to make plays on the perimeter. I do agree with you completely on the other side. They have to dominate Ohio State up front. Like, they do. They do. And Notre Dame's defensive line. I think a couple things I'd add is just you need to force them into mistakes, number one. Mistakes aren't always turnovers. Mistakes can also be – C.J. Stroud missed an open receiver, because this is what happens when you have a great pass rush. Your corner got burned, but he didn't have time to go to the number two read because the pressure was there, so he checked it down. They got a five-yard completion, but he made the mistake because he didn't see the outside go route coming open or the post route coming open or the deep drag coming open because he didn't have time to get there, or because the pressure is so consistent that even on a play where he maybe had time, his clock is so sped up that he's not getting to that third read, where that backside corner came open, where he may have banged that in most other games because he's had more time to throw. So those are mistakes. It's not an obvious mistake, because if you're watching at home, you didn't see that backside post route come open. You just saw a five-yard completion. And I think those are things they have to do. And then final, Notre Dame has to control the tempo of this game on both sides of the ball. They have to control the tempo, and that's a big part of it. Then a super sticker. If y'all want to know what it's like or how to become a really good starter as a freshman, and you have to have the psyche to be a successful freshman in college, that's my guy, Tim Opel. He actually started for us at Muhlenberg College. He was starting guard for us on a playoff team, first playoff team in school history. So nice. That's my guy, and was a big Notre Dame fan then. I wonder if he remembers when I got in trouble in the Gettysburg game. I got in trouble. The head coach, Coach Donnelly, who passed away recently, great, great guy, great mentor as a coach. But somebody narked on me in some of the stands. One of the parents narked on me and told him that I was checking my phone during the game, because it was an 0-2. Is when Notre Dame went down to play Florida State. This is that same day in Ty's first year. And so I'm like checking my little flip phone, you know, the digital, like the green screen and the black words, like to see the score of the game. And I got in trouble. But Tim and his brother are both Notre Dame fans. So love hearing from you, Tim. Hope you're doing well, buddy. Michael S. with a super chat. Comparison, Tyler Buchner and Lamar Jackson for college. I think they're very different players.
I mean, first and foremost, as athletes, we talked about Tyler Buchner as like an exceptional athlete, right, Brian? Like, what'd you say, like high 4.5, low 4.6 type of athlete, right? Like explosive, physical. Lamar Jackson's one of the best athletes we've seen come out of college in X amount of years, probably since Michael Vick. I mean, if we're being honest, like he is a just silly athlete, right? So I have trouble making that comparison. I will say this, at a young age, Tyler's probably more advanced from a getting through reads perspective, right, pocket awareness perspective, like that type of situation. But again, Lamar Jackson is one of the best dual threats that we've seen come out of college in a long time, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. I love when the fans who have been around for a long time are able to tune in, because we get such a different perspective to questions like best ever, right?
Yeah.
So Tom Flavin, who asked a great question, said, been following Notre Dame football since 1953. So he's seen some great ones. Rocket, Tony Rice, Paul Hornung, Tim Brown, and Alan Page.
Love it.
Hornung, 64 Hornung Brown, Heisman winners. Page was so good. He is also in the NFL Hall of Fame. And he's also a Supreme Court judge, I believe, in the state of Minnesota, correct? So tremendous
purple people eater back. That's right, man.
Yeah. So I love things like that. Really enjoy seeing those. That's why one of the many reasons I love talking to Lou Somogyi was, you know, Lou had such a great perspective on. I mean, he would talk to me about the, you know, how good Ross Browner was and how dominant Ross Browner was, and I just like the fact that even though he's got 35 years on me from a start point, that we still have two of the same guys, Rocket and Tony Rice.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I dig that. I dig that. But thanks for putting that list together, Tom. I appreciate that.
Yep.
Michael S. with a super chat. Is Tyler Buchner fragile in the mental game? It seems when things start to go bad, he starts to misfire a lot regarding some observations from practice. Your view. I can't report. Everybody keeps asking us, like, well, you guys said this and Irish Illustrated said this. So people see things differently. It's fine. It's not a big deal. Everybody's trying to, like, start some, well, they said Drew Pine was better. Okay, so what? That's what they saw. They're giving their honest opinion. We're giving our honest opinion. I would be shocked if somebody said that Tyler Buchner misfires a lot when things start to go bad. First of all, it was a non-padded practice. I doubt Tyler Buchner was worried about the pass rush. But I can't tell you what people are saying. All I know is every person that I've seen that's been in practices has been that I've talked to that I know said Tyler's been really good. And as far as the mental fragile, no, I not even close.
Isn't that one of his biggest strengths? Like, yeah. I feel like he's like an even keel kid. That's one of his biggest selling points.
Exactly.
He's never too high, never too low. But
Like I said, people can see different things and be honest in their assessment. Somebody's right, somebody's wrong, but people can, or sometimes it's like degrees or what you're looking for, but you know, it is what it is. Irish Chi-Town, Brian, from the outside looking in, it appears that the players have full trust in Coach Freeman. This didn't always seem to be the case with Coach Kelly. I believe that's true now, but I think there's one final layer for Marcus Freeman to completely earn his players' trust, and that's game days.
Yep.
I think they need success on game days to truly buy in, because, I'm completely bought in. I think these Notre Dame players are as bought in as I've seen since I've been here. Right. And I first started covering the team in person in 2010. And that's not a knock on Brian Kelly. It's just the reality of it. Okay. There's buy-in here, top to bottom, Freeman on down. There's buy-in here. But that's got to show that at some point in time, the results have to be there on the field. Because if you're bought in, but then you're not getting the results on the field, eventually that buy-in is going to be gone. And then it's vice versa. You know, you may be getting results on the field, but if you don't trust the coach, you're going to start thinking, well, this is more about us than it is him. And that's what we saw in the past. So that final piece, Ryan, is going to be important, is the results got to be there on Saturdays. If the results are there on Saturdays, then you're going to see complete buy-in and this team's going to be really, really good. Mm-hmm. But if they're struggling for the first month and a half of the season, you're going to see some doubts start to creep in with this team.
Well, I mean, stuff's already creeping in from a fan perspective, right? Like, I even parlay this to a little bit to the recruiting side of things. It's like people are panicking, right? But the one thing that can solidify everything is if they come out and they play well. You're like, oh, this guy really does know what he's doing, right? Yeah. Like, and not just the, you know, he carries himself well, and it's the, you know, just kind of that brand of everything. It's also like, wow, there's a bigger brand here too, right? Like, he knows what he's doing. So I agree completely.
Last question from Archer 452 is if Notre Dame is going to win a title in the next 3 years, which year sets up best for them, 2022, 2023, or 2024?
That's a good question.
You want to take a first crack at that, Ryan? I definitely have some thoughts on this question.
My initial thought is 2023. And the reason for that is I feel like the class that we spend the most time talking about a ton is the sophomore class this year. So that is the Joe Walt, Blake Fisher, Tyler Buchner, Logan Diggs, Audric Estime, like Lorenzo Styles, like that one. I think when those guys are juniors, obviously they're going to have the the extra year to hopefully get to their to closer to their ceilings. And I also think that at that point, a couple of those guys may be in contention to leaving the draft early. Like, I don't mm-hmm. think that they're all four-year players, obviously, right? So I think when you have that team as a juniors, you have this 2022 recruiting class that now is working in the sophomore years, and then you have those freshmen coming in. Hopefully a couple of them are – I mean, with how good that class is, I anticipate a couple of them coming in and having some type of impact mm-hmm. in 2023. That's where I think, like, collectively – you have what I think could be a star class for these the sophomore years, sophomore players this year, combined with these previous two classes. I think that that's where you, because yeah. that's where I really think that they could explode. Yeah. I think they have a chance to be really good this year, but like next year, when all those guys are a junior, I think that that's a really good opportunity.
It's kind of funny. That would actually be the year that I'd have at the bottom of my list of the three. And I understand completely, but the one part that I would talk about is what's the is the schedule set up for it? And I think, you know, next year you're talking about you got to play Ohio State at home. You got to go to Clemson. You've got NC State on the road. You know, 2024 schedule is going to be tough too. You got to play at USC and at Texas A&M. Very tough games. You know, but you get Miami at home. You get Virginia at home. You get Florida State at home. You get Stanford at home. So I think – and then to your point, there will be some guys gone in 2024 from that 21 class. You know, maybe Blake Fisher or Joe Alt or both. You know, you may not have Lorenzo Styles at that point in time. Chris Tyree is going to be gone. There's going to be some guys that are going to be gone. But I look at it and I say that 21 class, you're going to still have some guys left over. There's going to be some guys still here. The 22 class defensive class is going to be juniors then, which I think is an excellent class. And the 23 class, which is going to be phenomenal, will be sophomores. And you're then going to bring in the 2024 class, which I think is going to be loaded as well. So I just think from a pure athleticism standpoint, I really like that class. And playing against, you know, Texas A&M and USC, even though I do think USC is going to be pretty good by then, like really good by then, to me doesn't necessarily concern me as much as playing Clemson and Ohio State. So I think Tyler Buchner will be a senior then. Now, if you're going to be able to peer into the future and say Tyler Buchner's gone in 24, then 23 jumps up to number one on my list. And here's why. If Tyler Buchner's good enough to leave in 2023, after 23, it means Notre Dame had a phenomenal season. And sure. And that jumps him way up the list. But I anticipate him coming back as a third-year starter, and he's going to have Tobias Merriweather's going to be a junior. You know, one of Estime or Diggs will be back as seniors. You'll have Jadarian Price will be a junior. You'll have Eli Raritan and Holden Stace will be juniors. You're going to have the receiver class this year that's going to be sophomores. You're going to have, you know, the great defensive players in the 2022 class are, like I said, going to be juniors, plus Keon, and those guys are going to be sophomores. I think this is going to be a team that's going to be really long and athletic and talented by then. Yeah. You know, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what that team can be. How about all three?
Can we settle on that one?
Yeah, I think it'd be really good. And the other thing is, like, you know, is Riley Mills a fifth-year guy or not? You know, I mean, there's all types of things like that. But it's going to be fun to watch.
Is Lorenzo Styles back for his fourth year?
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
But I mean, even if I'm anticipating him not. I mean, even if he's not, it's like you talk about Tobias Merriweather is going to be a junior. Deion Colsey and Jaden Thomas will still be here. Plus, Greathouse, Braylon James, Dylan Edwards, Rico Flores, Eli Raritan, Holden Stace, Cooper Flanagan, Kane Barong. I mean, you kind of start looking at, boy, this is going to have a really talented group of guys. Yep. You know? And it just, that's part of what makes it fun. So that's going to do it for today's show, everybody. I want to appreciate all of y'all for being here with us today. Good crowd today. Good, much more lively and positive discussion about just today. It was just much better vibe, much not less arguing and bickering and all those different types of things. So I really appreciate y'all being a part of what we're doing here. Hit that like button, everybody. Hit that subscribe bell. Hit the notification bell. Share this podcast. And, of course, sign up for the message board. We finally, I think, got the bugs worked out. It was smoking fast last night, Ryan. Hasn't gone down the last couple days. As I say that, I got to have some wood. I don't know if this is real wood or not, but I'm knocking on it anyway. So hopefully this thing keeps rocking and rolling tonight. So tune in tonight at 6 o'clock Eastern. Sean Stiers is going to be back. They're going to talk about linebackers. I think they're going to have some thoughts on the freaks list as well. So you'll get a different perspective on that. And then they're going to talk a lot about the Notre Dame linebackers. Obviously, Sean was there yesterday got to interview Al Golden, got to interview James Laurinaitis, got to interview the Notre Dame players. So they're going to talk a lot about the Notre Dame linebackers tonight and more, even more about the Notre Dame practices. So really appreciate y'all very, very much. We're both trying to click on Mace's thing at the same time. So take Mace AK's advice, everybody. And if you're listening via podcast, please give us a five-star review. We would appreciate that very, very much. And visit the IB store to get that smooth Brian and Ryan polo, as you can't see it if you're listening via podcast, but it is a really, really sweet polo and very comfortable. That's the other thing. It's very comfortable. Anyway, have a great day, everybody, and we'll talk to you again very, very soon.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.